hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. Tonight, I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting and calling down to be. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me. The guy who claims he just don't believe in fight. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in a part of the dive. If we don't love it, leave it. Love this song I'm singing, be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side. Running down with life, I'm fighting in a fog-tied key. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. And you're running down my country, man. You're walking on right beside me.
When you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people. And, of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia, New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and, of course, all of you who may be listening tonight. Listening to them this morning. In the European heartland. Well, lots more news and views for you. And let's see. Our trust fund kid. That's the Canadian Prime Minister. Great admirer of communist China. Great admirer of. He's an admirer of Cuba, communist Cuba. Let me see. What else is he famous for? Oh yeah, yes. Well, he loves taking. Posing for pictures, gay pride parades with any of a collection of weirdos and freaks. So he's big on that, big on gay pride parades. He's a great friend of the Muslims. Great friend of the Muslims, great friend of the Sikhs. He calls himself a feminist. I have no reason to doubt it. Anyway, the trust fund kid, he's all about, at least according to his spokesman, he's being consistent about this, to be fair to him. He's all about fighting global warming. Oh, I'm sorry, there isn't global warming anymore. What's it being changed to? It's climate change. Well, I guess you can't miss on climate change. Climate's always changing. So anyway, we're going to do something about that. He's bringing in a carbon tax. Oh, that'll really help. That'll really change things. Well, you know, if you can't even pin down exactly what it is that's happening, how can you be sure that the measures you're bringing in will in fact do any good? You know, the idea was, it was, you know, up until just yesterday, it was global warming, and the nonsense put out there was, You know, it's all our fault. That's right. It's your fault. If you drive an automobile, or your community uses coal for an electrical generator, or you fly an airplane, all that carbon is heating up the atmosphere. So it was said. It is amazing how stupid, profoundly stupid, this age is. I say that. Because this should not pass the smell test with a first-year university science student. I'll tell you why. Okay, global warming, we're told, was as a result of all the carbon in the atmosphere, and somehow that heats the Earth up. Okay, interesting theory. Problem is, the Earth has heated up many times before, in the distant past and in the relatively recent past. For instance, in the Middle Ages, beginning around, about 800 or 900, the Earth heated up. This allowed the Vikings to hip-hop their way across the North Atlantic, first to Iceland, then to Greenland, then to Baffin Island, and the east coast of the United States, Canada, Newfoundland, Labrador, and very likely deep into the Great Lakes. But anyway, that's another story. And then around 1400, it cooled off. So that by Shakespeare's time, in the late 1500s and early 1600s, you could skate on the Thames, which you cannot do today. But if the Earth was warming up because of carbon emissions, how did that happen? There was virtually no coal use. Of course, there wasn't gasoline. Why did the Earth heat up? The guilt-mongering allegation that it's all our fault, that holds absolutely zero water. The only way you can make that monster fly is by lying or cooking the figures. In fact, that's what the scientists did until they were caught. In fact, to make a long story short, global warming is caused by sunspots, as is cooling. And as yet, other than a wing and a prayer, nobody's yet come up with a brilliant idea as to how to deal with the sunspots. So these are explosions on the surface of the sun. It gets even more ridiculous. Turns out, very likely, the world isn't getting warm. In fact, 40 years ago, the big scare tactic of the day was the coming ice age. Well, now there's some reason to believe that the Earth is not getting warmer. Whether there's a coming ice age, and I've talked to people who think there is, but I'm not totally convinced. But again, it has nothing to do. Oh, wait a sec. But if global warming was tied to carbon emissions, or so we were told, and there is no global warming, well then, why should we be worrying about carbon? What does it matter? It doesn't matter. And now it's climate change. Well, you see what I mean about absolutely illogical. But just because it's illogical doesn't mean that there aren't people who support it. Anyway, what's it going to cost Canada? This self-flagellation. We're going to fight global warming. I'm sorry, we're going to fight climate change. We're going to punish ourselves with a carbon tax. All right? The introduction of a federal carbon tax could shrink Canada's GDP by as much as $3 billion in 2018 and lead to a slight depreciation of the Canadian dollar, reports. Is that, of course, it's going to continue. It's not as though this will be a one-time punishment. It's a punishment that will increase because the people planners and manipulators will want us to stop using carbon, gasoline and things like that. So we're going to be punished for that. Now we've got to get these control freaks off our backs. You know, I don't need to be punished. In fact, I don't need people to to tell me what to do. Yeah, believe it or not, as a functioning adult, I can more or less figure out on my own what to do. Anyway, so the carbon tax initially is going to cost shrink the Canadian gross domestic product by $3 billion and cause a slight depreciation in the Canadian dollar. In a study released Tuesday, the Conference Board of Canada said the tax could cause a broad slowdown in economic activity as higher energy prices ripple throughout the economy. Prices for natural gas, gasoline, electricity, and other goods will rise, collectively raising costs of goods and services. Well, duh! Canada is a country that is very dependent on long-distance transportation to transport food, a lot of food coming from the United States or even further south. We have a sparse population spread over quite long distances. In fact, most of our population is huddled within 100 miles of the American border. We have quite a lot of density in places like the GTA, the Greater Toronto Area, or Vancouver and the lower mainland of British Columbia, but big spaces in between. So, point being, transportation is a big factor in Canada. We're not a compact place like, say, Germany or France or Japan. With higher prices for gasoline or diesel or whatever, naturally, goods that have to be shipped that way will be, more expensive, right? But, you know, again, this doesn't take a genius to figure. It should not take a genius to figure this out. Anyway, this will be a multiplying effect as the carbon tax increases thereafter. Presumably, prices will go up too. Oh, that's good. Punish those people. The negative effect on growth moves the economy away from its potential, and this results in a mild depreciation of the Canadian dollar, according to the Conference Board. The Conference Board expects the negative repercussions for the Canadian economy to, they think it'll taper off after a few years. Carbon-intensive industries are hit the hardest, consumers take a hit, and then we start to grow our way out of it again. Well, that's their hope. The report's findings come as Ottawa prepares to introduce its carbon tax proposal to Parliament in the fall. The floor price on the tax would start at $10 per ton in 2018 and will rise another $10 every year for the next 4 years. Ottawa will set annual mandatory minimums for the carbon price and will place levies on provinces that don't meet its targets. With a carbon tax of $50 per ton, natural gas prices will rise 20%. Oh, that's great if you're heating your house with natural gas. Regardless of what the market might dictate, it means it'll be 20% more expensive. Believe me, most people's wages won't be going up 20%.
To the dedicated canine
At a $200 per ton price, that's carbon tax, prices would rise 60%. In manufacturing, paper, chemical, and petroleum product makers are expected to be hit hardest by rising prices. Paper manufacturers' costs will rise 30% at $50 per ton and more than 80% at $200 per ton. This could make large areas of the Canadian economy uncompetitive. It's absolutely brutalizing the taxpayer. Well, hopefully it will not pass. Maybe I should amend that. Let us hope enough citizens will speak up and perhaps deter the trust fund kid from this. But it remains to be seen. As long as the Liberals have a majority, and they do, and as long as they all move in lockstep, like so many quacking ducks or clapping seals. Well, I guess we'll have it. Here's a a big ad from the Saturday National Post, and it's one of these things that the Jewish lobby tends to do fairly well. They love to throw dinners to honor themselves or to honor people in their community. And I've been told by Barbara Emile, and she's Jewish, and this is when she was on friendly terms with me many years ago, that Jews with means often find themselves seriously pressured into not only attending these high-priced dinners, but also to sponsor. And what they're trying to do is to rope not only other Jews in, but even non-Jews to give themselves legitimacy. So this is the CJ PAC, Canadian Jewish Political Action Committee. The Canadian Jewish Action Committee thanks our impact dinner honoree, Lillian Weinberg, committee members and generous sponsors for making the evening such a success. So this is a recent shindig they had in Montreal. And this is a color ad that would take up at least half of one page. Now, that's pricey to basically pat themselves on the back and having various of the notables grinning and so on. Impact Action Montreal dignitaries, the Honorable Stephen Blaney, the Honorable Stephen Blaney. And I'm sorry to see Stephen Blaney there. He ran for the Conservative Party leadership. He was the Minister of Public Safety for a period during the Harper government, and in many ways, I think a good man. And it's disappointing that he would be there. Anyway, he wasn't the only one. All sorts of Jews who hold public office. He's not a Jew. We're there. Let's see. Stephen Blaney, Councillor Nicholas Bourne from Laval, Councillor Warren Budning from Hampstead. These are bedroom communities around Montreal. Guy Carona, he's a separatist member of NDP member of Parliament. The Honorable Tony Clement. Well, Clement is not. He doesn't even live in Quebec, and he's not a Jew. He's a member of Parliament. Councillor Mike Cohen, Côte Saint-Luc. Councillor David Ducote, Laval. Councillor Manon Gauthier in Champlain. Councillor Michael Goldwax, Jewish, from Hampstead. Councillor Mickey Gutman, Jewish, from Dollard Des Armeaux. Anthony Housefather, a member of Parliament, not sure what he is. I won't read all the names because many of them would probably only be of interest if you live in Montreal. There's, of course, the Deputy Rotem Segev, Deputy Consul General of Israel in Montreal. Randeep Sarai, a member of Parliament. He's certainly not a Jew. So what they try to do is to rope in as many people from the outside community as they can to add oomph and respectability. Then they've got platinum sponsors. Most of these seem to be Jews. Heather Weissman, she heads up Canada's biggest book retailer. Goes under several names. Indigo Books is one, and Chapters is another. And they've got diamond sponsors. Most of these seem to be Jews as well. Gold sponsors. The National Post is a sponsor. Now, the National Post, bloody believable. The National Post, of course, was founded, was owned by, for quite a while, by big Jewish interests. Israel Asper was part of his media empire. But the National Post is losing money hand over fist.
And you wonder why they would be a gold sponsor. Now, we're not told exactly how much money you have to toss in to be a gold sponsor, but if I were a shareholder in the National Post, I would be raising absolute cane. Let's see. Emerald sponsors. These are, I guess, would kick in a little bit less. Most of these seem to be Jews, although RBC, that's Royal Bank of Canada, Canada's largest bank, wealth management department. Yeah, you know, if I were a shareholder with them, I would be furious at this waste of money and this catering to one community. And then there are silver sponsors and bronze sponsors. Most of these seem to be Montreal area Jews. Well, don't have any problem with Jews supporting Jewish causes, but it's the horn swaddling the greater community to do that annoys me. But it is interesting how these Jewish groups operate and hold dinners and regularly honor one another. And I mean, you can hardly blame them for that. And it might be something that people on our side of the fence might take to heart as a way of proceeding. There's an interesting article in today's National Post, it was about a fellow named Robson, as to whether maybe this would be the time to go to war against North Korea. Maybe put it a little different. A serious preemptive strike. And he made some interesting points. I'm not sure I'm 100% sold, but he made some interesting points. Among them were the following. North Korea is a third-rate power. It does have some nuclear weapons. It may well have ICBM delivery capability. That's not sure. It does have several ICBMs. It could reach the western part of North America and the United States. To say nothing of its near neighbors, Japan and South Korea. Whether it is miniaturized nuclear weapon to the sufficiently, that's not certain, but the fact is, if they haven't, they soon will. Despite years of sanctions, trade sanctions, shunning, and so on, the current weirdo in charge in North Vietnam, part of this dynasty, the Kim dynasty, Kim Jong-un, seems intent on building a nuclear arsenal, no matter what most of the other nations in the world say about it, and threatening his neighbors. Now, the United States is, by any reasonable measure, the greatest military power in the world today, with a huge air, sea, and land capabilities. It has repeatedly urged North Korea to pull back. North Korea has simply waggled its yellow finger at the Americans for years. Under both Bush and Obama, efforts were made to bribe the North Koreans. If they would behave a little better, trade sanctions would be lifted and they would do better financially. Well, that didn't work. Well, then, for a time, there were supposed to be negotiations that would bring about some sort of lessening of the nuclear threat. Well, they didn't work either. The North Koreans would talk, but just continued building the nuclear weaponry. What can be done about them? See, there is a matter of credibility, and this fellow Robson was pointing out, and again, I'm not 100% sold on this idea, but it to some extent it makes sense. He was pointing out that, well, look, just for self-defense, South Korea and Japan may have to go nuclear. because if it does not appear that the United States will make good on its threats, and Trump said that threatened that there would be a firestorm like they had never seen before if Korea didn't back off. North Korea even threatened the American bases in Guam. So at some point, you've got to make good on your threats, or your threats will actually be of no import at all. And it may well be that other countries like Japan that have signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty may, for their own self-defense, have no choice but to go nuclear. And many people would think that's not a good thing, not because it's Japan, but the more countries with nuclear power, the more danger there is of something going seriously wrong. Okay, well then, what could be done? And he pointed out that there seems to be almost a yes minister, and that was a great British comedy about politics, and about a manipulative advisor to a cabinet minister, and then to who eventually became prime minister, and how cleverly the civil service would manipulate these people. But it was a comedy satire, but it made a lot of good points. And one of the points that was made, and it's only partly satirical, is the way the civil service handles the problem would be this. At first you deny there is a problem. Then you admit there is a problem, but say it's not serious. And then you say that, yes, there is a problem, it is serious, but there's nothing we can do about it. All the while letting time pass and in the hopes that people will forget about it or move on to some other issue. These seem to be the voices largely raised on the issue of what to do about North Korea. It's a given that nothing can be done about it. You couldn't go to war. Well, okay, why not? Well, the short answer is North Korea has huge artillery aimed at South Korea, and the South Korean capital is Seoul, with I think 16 million people, is less than 50 miles from the border, and could in fact be pulverized, or let's say seriously damaged, by even just a massive artillery response. And what Robson said was, well, but America has immense resources that can be brought to bear. For one thing, cruise missiles. This artillery is not hidden, it's out in the open. Cruise missiles plus artillery on the south could probably neutralize or nearly neutralize the North Korean artillery, in addition to massive bombing. This would prevent the immediate devastating response, or at least seriously muted. The other part of the operation, much more important, would be to try to take out the North Korean leadership and or the nuclear weaponry as well. Now, I'm not a warmonger, and I'm not a person who believes that we should ever use violence lightly or casually. I think he made an impressive point. PR firm CEO resigns amid growing South African furor. Now, there has been seriously anti-white racist advertising in South Africa recently, and it's come to the attention of the opposition Democratic Party, and not to be confused with American Democrats. Anyway, anyway, but the story gets even worse. Here it goes. The chief executive of Bell Pottinger, one of the world's biggest and most famous public relations firms, has resigned in a growing scandal over the firm's racially tinged campaign on behalf of a powerful South African business family. The London-based agency, founded by Margaret Thatcher's former spin doctor, we'd be very curious to know his ethnicity, had gained notoriety for polishing the images of repressive regimes and autocrats around the world. But it got into serious trouble for its work in South Africa, where it is accused of fueling racial hatred in a country struggling to overcome. James Henderson, the firm's CEO, resigned on the weekend as the firm prepared to release an independent review of its South African campaign. A British industry group, the Public Relations and Communications Association, will release its own ruling on Tuesday in response to a complaint from a South African opposition party. If it finds against Bell Pottinger, it could expel the firm from its membership. Bell Pottinger has already apologized for its role in an expensive and highly divisive campaign against white monopoly capital. What was that? They're a white firm. This is what I call race treason. This is being done not by blacks, or actually the clients are not even blacks, they're Indians and very powerful South African Indian family, the Gupta brothers, who are exceedingly corrupt and have big inroads into the ruling Communist African National Congress. And they have gotten contracts and they have made scads of money. They're a dirty lot, polish the image of the Guptas, the advertising campaign said that their enemies, the people that are critical of the Guptas, and their serious power with the government. The Indians, these Indian big Indian businessmen with a lot of power over the nominally socialist communist African National Congress. And the Gupta brothers are billionaires. They have extensive ties to South African President Jacob Zuma. In fact, one of their close associates is Zuma's son. And the agency dismissed or suspended four staff in July when it apologized for what it admitted was offensive and unethical behavior. Now, I don't want to take this issue too much further, but you've got to wonder, for a big contract like that, did the higher-ups have no idea what was going on? Or was it a matter of wink, wink, nudge, nudge, see what we can get away with. What particularly offends me is that here we have white people actively defaming other white people on the basis of race. In my book, that's race treason. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighty side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Back with you in just a couple of minutes. Going to take a short musical interlude here, and this is Merle Haggard, of course, who is the artist whose song, The Fighting Side of Me, I've adopted as the signature tune for this show. Anyway, here's another song by Merle, The Bottle Let Me Down.
Hey, thank you, man. That's one of my old man's favorite songs. We don't smoke in the dark. Silver wheat. Bottle let me down. Each night I meet the barroom in Dover. Not dealing in the pain and closing time. But tonight your memory found me much too sober. I couldn't drink enough to keep you on my mind.
And that's Merle Haggard tonight. Bottle Let Me Down. Well, got to take another song here by another country and western entertainer. And this is also, of course, Merle, and this is the Working Man Blues, very much close to his heart.
I bought this coat here today, and I'm not used to having things hanging off my arm. I thought a spider was crawling. I thought it matched the joint. Isn't this a beautiful place, really? This is really not a joint, is it? We're used to playing joints. Play joints all of our life. You will. With your word? Nothing else? We're going to do a song here that we dedicated by 1968 to all the working men in the world. It's a big job getting by with nine kids and a wife. Yeah, but I've been a working man, staying here all my life, and keep on working. Long as my dear hands are with you. Drink my beer in heaven and then sing a little bit of these working man blues. Well, I keep my nose on the grindstone, work hard every day. Might get a little tired on the weekend. After I draw my pay, then I go back working. Come Monday morning, right back with the crew. Drink my beer in the tavern and then sing a little bit of these working man blues. Well, sometimes I think about me, just a little bump day around. Throw my bill out the window, get to the street, put another down, but I go back working.
That was Merle Haggard and Working Man Blues. Going to play one more tune here on our musical interlude tonight here on the Fighting Side of Me. This is Paul Fromm, and I think we'll play this is also by Merle Haggard. I guess this has been a bit of a Merle Haggard appreciation tonight, and certainly he deserves it. This is called Rambling Fever, Merle Haggard.
And then we got into a thing called rambling fever, one like something like this. Heard a lonesome guitar blow.
hang around that fever all along. The bed down on the sofa. Let some pretty lady rub my back and spend the early morning drinking coffee, talking about when I'd be coming back. Yeah, but I don't let no woman tie me down. I'll never get too old to get around. I want to die along the highway.
Sam Earl Haggard, Rambling Fever, and this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, famous ancestors or good ancestors, it's unfortunately not a guarantee of good descendants. I've seen this in many instances in life, and this is kind of a sad story, but Robert E. Lee's descendant resigns as pastor over racial justice comments. A descendant of Confederate General Robert E. Lee has stepped down as pastor of a North Carolina church after negative reactions to his comments supporting racial justice during an MTV award show. Well, racial justice, though, this requires some explanation. The general's distant nephew, the Reverend Robert W. Lee IV, said he resigned from the Bethany United Church of Christ in Winston-Salem after the congregation decided to put his tenure to a vote.
Yeah, they're going to vote his ass out of there.
Well, what did he do? He said some church members were uncomfortable with his remarks praising the Black Lives Matter movement during the August 27th MTV Video Music Awards. He was introducing the mother of Heather Heyer, who was killed during the demonstrations over a statue of Robert E. Lee in Charlottesville, Virginia. Lee also used the remarks to lament that his ancestor had become a symbol of racism. I don't think anybody of those people who were protesting the removal of the Robert E. Lee statue were there honoring him because he was a racist. I don't think Robert E. Lee was a racist. In fact, he had not initially supported secession, but he was a man strongly bound by duty and a sense of duty, particularly a duty to his own state of Virginia. And when it seceded, he felt called upon to answer the call to protect his state. And support for Black Lives Matter, it's hard to imagine how any decent white person could support Black Lives Matter, because they are militantly anti-white, prone to violence, and prone to the most extreme types of statements. And there's something immensely hypocritical about Black Lives Matter. It presumes that Black lives don't matter. Well, the people who most need that message, Black Lives Matter, are not white people. It's blacks. The biggest cause of death, statistically, the biggest cause of death for young blacks aged 16 to 30 is another young black. Young black is more likely to be gunned down or shot or stabbed or otherwise killed by another black than by whites, or by being felled by some disease, or dying in a motor accident. Homicide by other blacks is the leading cause of death for young blacks. Now, should Black Lives Matter be hooting and hollering at white society? Well, no. They should be carrying their message to fellow blacks. But of course, that's not very sexy, is it? And that's of course not what they're paid to do by George Soros, who has funded so many of these agitational groups. Well, front page of today's National Post is the sad tale about the Rohingyas. Now, the Rohingyas are a minority of Muslims living in overwhelmingly Buddhist Burma. Now it's called, what is it called? Myanmar. Gotta wonder about countries who are always changing their name. Anyway, Burma, Myanmar, whatever. They're not considered citizens of Burma. They're considered very much outsiders, and they're considered basically interlopers from Bengal. They're of a different religion, and so on. They've got a guerrilla movement which attacked some other civil government installations, and the government has attacked back and driven a fair number of them out of the country, and they're fleeing. as many as maybe 400,000 have fled to squalid refugee camps in Bangladesh. And the plight of the Rohingyas, I guess, is not very high on our list. You would think perhaps Muslims would take up the cause, you know. It's easier to fight white people, but it's a delicious story of hypocrisy. And I always love third world hypocrisy. And there's a woman named Aung San Suu Kyi. So Suu Kyi. Anyway, Aung San Suu Kyi won the Nobel Prize, and she was under house arrest and exile for quite a while because of the military junta. Her father was one of the founders of Burma, and a general, and he was assassinated. And she's married an Englishman, and actually is not eligible, apparently, to become president, because under the previous rules, you can't be married to a foreigner. Anyway, but she's quite the liberals' darling. Well, now Suu Kyi is attracting a fair deal of criticism because she hasn't spoken out about the persecution of the Rohingyas, or the alleged persecution of the Rohingyas. Now, her party forms the government now. So I think it's pretty fair to to say that, you know, that not all those who holler about human rights necessarily practice that. Another thing that the naive and foolish people don't realize is that ethnic and religious dislikes are every bit as strong in the third world. In fact, probably much stronger than they are in the European world. Buddhists don't like Muslims because Muslims are aggressive and so on. The racially different Burmese, who are much more Oriental, don't particularly like the Bengalis or the Bangladeshis. There really are ethnic dislikes, and you know what? It's human nature. That's why all this this caterwauling against racism, where it is sincere, and quite often it's not sincere at all, but where it is sincere, it is a result of a bad misreading of human nature. People prefer their own group. There's nothing wrong with that. In fact, it's really quite healthy. And to pretend that they, or to insist that they not prefer their own group, or face the penalty of being denounced as, you know, racist, is just plain unrealistic, goes against human nature, and isn't going to happen. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern time. Shows repeated in the morning and 4 in the afternoon. All those are Eastern Standard Time, and I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf, forever, played by the 48th Highlanders.